Open up the Senate Committee on Commerce. We have a number of bills that are here for public hearing. It's marked for public hearing and work session. The chair's intent is not to move any of the bills today. What we're going to do today is get as much public hearing testimony in as we can. I apologize for running a little bit late. The issues are that all five of us sit on another committee that goes till 3. We went till 3:10. Accordingly, what we're going to try to do, I have members that are needing to come and go because of other commitments and other hearings, and so we're going to have people floating in and out during that. I apologize if we can't all be here for the full time. We will be taking testimony today. I also know that I have to probably have this closed down by 5. I'm going to ask that you listen to each other, and if you need to supplement testimony, feel free to do so. But at the same time, we're going to ask you not to just repeat everything that you may have heard, but we do want you to be on the record. With that said, we're going to start with Senate Bill 319. And what I'm going to try to do is work off of the witness list with proponents, then opponents. I'm going to do panels, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask for the, on 319, I have 5 individuals at this point that are set to testify in favor of, and so we'll start with the top of that list is Dan Swift, Bob Livingston, and Brian Delashmet, excuse me. And then after that, we have J.C. Cook or Cork, and then Charles Carter will be the next of those panels. And then we'll go into the, where I need a highway map on this one. We have 4 individuals at this point that are scheduled to speak in opposition. I also understand that there has been a request that photographs be taken during the hearing. There's no objection to that. Everything is being telecast, and like that, all I ask is that you not interfere with the testimony and make sure you stay off to the sides. Gentlemen, I'll let you start as, with whoever should go first.
Mr. Chair, members of this committee, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and it would be my intent today to just give you a brief overview of what we believe the merits are in 319, and if it pleases the chair, then have my colleagues here weigh in on it a little bit. I'm not going to go into great detail. I have provided you with written testimony, but I think there are a couple of points that I would like to point out regarding 319, and if I could, Mr. Chair, would it be the intent of the chair to then have information on 319 and then have an additional hearing on 320 and then 321?
Yes, I think for our record keeping and for I will not be in hot water with Karen, we are going to do bill by bill.
Okay, thank you. That helps me. Thank you very much. Senate Bill 319 simply is a bill that would, in our opinion, add some clarity to Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act. Some of you may remember in the 1995 session, significant changes and reforms were made to PECBA as we know it, that stood in place since the inception of the PECBA law from 1973. What this bill would simply do is, in our opinion, provide clarity, particularly to how, if in fact you do go to all the way the distance in interest arbitration, and just for your information for those that aren't familiar with it, many employees such as police officers and firefighters and others are excluded from striking, and so when there's not an agreement at the bargaining table, the provision applies that an interest arbitrator will make a final decision. One of the things that happened in 1995 is that they changed the criteria, not so much as an overarching change in the criteria, but what they did do is they made the interest and welfare of the public the primary consideration that an arbitrator has to look at. However, after 10 years under this bill, one of the things that I think both sides would potentially agree on is that, unfortunately, there's no measurability to interest and welfare of the public. And if you look through the records of the arbitrations, what you will find is that many of the arbitrators simply believe that, and I'll quote one of the arbitrators, that when it comes to interest and welfare of the public, many arbitrators have concluded that the interest and welfare of the public cannot be evaluated without reference reference to the secondary criteria. And so what this bill simply would do is not eliminate interest and welfare of the public, but tie it in to interest and welfare of the public and the financial ability to pay, and would weigh the criteria equally. One of the things that we think this bill would do is not only provide more clarity, but it provides more measurability, and therefore you give a better chance of having a resolution and not even going to arbitration. One of the key elements that I would like to point out before I turn it over to Mr. DeLashmit is that in some of the other reforms that took place in 1995, none of the three bills that we will discuss today eliminate probably one of the most important provisions, at least of the people that voted for the bill in 1995, and that's the elimination of the last final best offer, meaning that no longer can an arbitrator pick and choose certain elements of a contract on either labor side or management side. It's an all-or-nothing package. And so what this bill simply does allow for is clarity for an arbitrator, clarity for sides when they can't reach an agreement, and it certainly does not eliminate that last final best offer, which, whether you like it or not, I think both sides have to agree that it has brought both sides to the table closer and trying to work out their differences prior to an arbitrator. So with that, simply all we're trying to do is provide a little bit of clarity on the ambiguity that the interest and welfare of the public has not only caused problems for labor and management, but also for arbitrators. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian DeLashman. I'm here representing a number of organizations today in the public safety area, the Oregon Council of Police Associations, which many of you are likely familiar with, which is an organization of independent police, corrections, and parole and probation officers around the state. Second organization is Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the third organization is the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. Altogether, I suspect I probably represent about 5,000 or more people on these particular issues. Of the three bills today, and we will talk about them separately, this one is, I guess I would say, a little bit more technical, but Bob's done a pretty good job of simplifying it down to basically an issue of trying to level the playing field on the criteria. In 750, what they in essence did is they elevated the interest in public of the welfare to a higher level of criteria. And as he's described, obviously arbitrators do, and not in all cases, but in many cases, have a problem of getting past that to actually evaluate the second tier of criteria. As he's also, and without much time spent on repeating what Mr. Livingston indicated, one of the things that you really need to focus on in this is that this bill, and you may hear that this is a massive reform to the provisions of Senate Bill 750 from 1995, I would contend that it is very, very modest in its changes, in that it does not revert back to the old ability for an arbiter to pick and choose from among items as if it was kind of a Chinese menu and saying, well, I'll take the salary here, I'll take the benefits here, I'll take this issue there. This retains the basic changes of Senate Bill 750 as far as the winner-take-all interest arbitration. We have had discussions amongst our organizations, and I'll be very straight with you, in which a number of the members wanted to go back to the old system, and we said one of the values of the revisions of 750 was that it didn't make both sides focus down to what they was really essential when they got down to where they finally couldn't agree and an arbiter needed to make a decision. And you can still argue about whether or not that was totally successful, but from the perspective of, I think, both sides, there really has been a narrowing of the issues. So all we're really asking for here is, in fact, a leveling of the criteria so that arbiters can, in fact, look at the entire scheme of both packages and make a determination. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Swift.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Daniel Swift. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. We represent the rank and file state troopers, forensic scientists, and telecommunicators who work for the Department of State Police. Quite simply, without rehashing in the interest of time, the Oregon State Police Officers Association strongly is in support of this bill. We feel it would make some necessary changes in the current law. And more importantly, it's very necessary for the men and women who actually deliver, who are at the point of service and deliver the emergency services that are required by the citizens of the state, to have this so they have some protection when sitting in negotiation and arbitration with whatever their entity is they have to negotiate with. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And what I'm going to do is I just want to confirm. I've got a note that was passed up to me, and I believe I think it's J.C. Cock and Roy Carter do not need to testify on Senate Bill 319. If that's not correct, please come forward quickly, and if not, we'll put you on the list for 320. Not seeing anyone come forward, then I'm going to ask for Mr. Watt, is it Aiken Blitz, and I've got Scott Lazenby, and then Miles Ward. Now, I don't know if you want to bring a fourth chair up or if you want to just do it in panels of two.
I have these.
Okay. Thank you, John. And who wants to start?
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Aiken Blitz. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, and the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Good afternoon.
Thank you for the consolidation and all into one.
Well, it was a stretch just to remember all of them. I have practiced labor law here in Oregon for over 30 years, and my practice focuses in public safety and the public sector. I have served as a police officer in this state. I continue to be a commissioned police officer in this state. My purpose in coming at the request of local government and public safety employers is simply to try to educate the members of the committee on some of the complexities of these bills. There's a lot more at work here than a simple leveling of the playing field or clarification of issues that are presented in the law in its current form. My purpose is simply to help you understand so that the committee will be in a better position to make the public policy choices that are yours to make as members of the legislature. Certainly there is a desire to do something more for public employees, and that has never been greater than the aftermath of 9/11, compounded by Oregon's current financial situation and the blows dealt to all public employees in the state, the raw deal that they feel they're receiving in the PERS litigation and the PERS legislation. These bills, each of them, represent a significant incursion into core management rights, and management abhors each of them as contrary to the public interest. My purpose here, again, is to explain why. But let there be no misunderstanding. I do not intend for my testimony to be received as union bashing or confrontational or adversarial in any way to the ideas that labor is propounding in each of these bills. I count many friends among the police officers, the men and women of service, police officers and firefighters in the state. Some of them are here in the room today. I also respect the imperative of providing the ability and preserving the ability in our police chiefs and our sheriffs and our fire chiefs to lead and manage their agencies and to make critical decisions concerning the service delivery systems of public safety. The issues are extremely complicated. Bargaining is simply not the answer to every issue. Every issue in public sector employment is not susceptible to a democratic or a bargained process. That is not to say, however, with respect to some of these issues, that the parties should not bargain, and indeed they do. But they do so on a permissive basis. And the critical thing to understand about these bills is that once we make a subject a mandatory subject of bargaining, in contrast with a permissive one, then we invite the kind of posturing that I have experienced at the bargaining table in order and the advancement of more issues to litigation in the interest arbitration context. I've watched this over my career. Every issue of concern to a firefighter or a police officer can be linked in a legal argument to officer or firefighter safety, because we all understand that firefighting and law enforcement services on the street have inherent dangers in them. The good news about a pregnant pause in this testimony is I am cutting the presentation. What unions are seeking is ever more concessions from the Legislative Assembly with respect to a well-established, balanced statutory scheme, which is the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act, and which was hammered out in the legislature with the help of Senator Kulongowski. I'm sorry, with the help of Professor Henry Drummonds, at the behest of Governor Kitzhaber. Interest arbitration bargaining units in Oregon already enjoy raw bargaining power vastly in excess of any other labor organization that we deal with. And it's important that each of you understand that this is a costly dynamic. A public safety union, an interest arbitration union, has the power, by asserting that something is a mandatory subject, to demand to bargain over a midterm change in that subject and halt the city's implementation of change that relates to that subject, and in bargaining an extension of a contract, to propose a mandatory subject and hold the public employer hostage to the interest arbitration process if there's a failure to agree. It alters dramatically the relative bargaining power of labor and management that prevails in teacher negotiation, for example, or public service negotiation, or negotiation with any of the non-interest arbitration state bargaining units. The Public Employers of Oregon ask you to adopt management's approach to these issues. We favor a hands-off approach because we believe the law is balanced today, and it favors stability and predictability in a volatile area of the law. This is now for three sessions subsequent to Senate Bill 750. Various management and labor representatives have been here attempting to seek advantage in the tilt of what has been described as the playing field of labor relations. And I think it's a bad public policy for the legislature to entertain year after year labor and management's respective efforts to come bargain with the legislature over how the balance of power ought to be struck. If we're going to take a look at that issue, we need to take a look at it the way we did in Senate Bill 750 globally. And I am not going to go through the two pages of illustrative issues in my testimony. There for the purpose of underscoring for you, if you are willing to take the time and glance over it, there are a number of issues with which management is unhappy in the current statutory scheme. We're living with it. We've had discussions with this governor and Governor Kitzhaber midterm and during the session. And the consistent message from the governor's office has been, hands off. We've been there. Everybody got their chance at Senate Bill 750. Don't come back year after year after year on these labor issues to tweak the playing field. So at pages 3, 4, and 5, there are single-space paragraphs talking about issues in Senate Bill 750 with which we disagree. Turning to Senate Bill 319, that bill revisits a compromise that was hammered out by the governor and Henry Drummonds, and the bill would alter factors that arbitrators are directed to rely upon in considering the final offers that are brought before them. Those are final offers in interest arbitration where the parties are compelled by law to submit all their bargaining issues that remain open to an interest arbitrator, and the interest arbitrator decides and in essence picks, as has been pointed out to you, the last best offer of one side or the other, which becomes the labor contract for its term, generally the subsequent up to 3 years. By reducing the significance of the interest and welfare of the public and eliminating the significance of governing bodies to the priority for services and funding levels as are established in the budget, the interest arbitrator has the power to second guess and alter because of the economic demands of labor in the arbitration process. The arbitrator may alter the service priority decisions of the city council or the county board of commissioners between competing demands for service. In the state, during the last year and a half, our firm assisted the Department of Justice in 3 or 4 interest arbitrations where the state police, FOPO, and other interest arbitration units sought to second guess the funding decisions of the Legislative Assembly and the Governor's Office in the budget and find a way to force the state to appropriate more money to fund the labor settlements. This is a bad idea, and let me just underscore it with an example from the city of Hillsborough, where I spend a good deal of time periodically. In the news this week, it was reported that the city had discovered a $1.5 million deficit in the current fiscal year. This circumstance is driven by depressed assessed values, particularly in the high-tech and industrial sector, decreases in franchise fees, the ability of high-volume industrial consumers to purchase out-of-state power and avoid franchise fees paid by local utilities, and other factors, including a decline of building activity. In the next year, the city anticipates different impacts, which will further erode Hillsborough's fiscal health. And those impacts include increased cost in personnel services of between 8% and 9%, due in part to the cost of living and to wage adjustments that have already been collectively bargained. A 4.5% increase, and perhaps more that we'll learn about later based on how the Supreme Court rules, relative to PERS contributions. And that 4.5% increase is an increase in payroll dollars. It's actually a 38% increase in the contributions paid to PERS on behalf of employees. Not to mention a 10 to 20% increase in the cost of health insurance, which in Hillsborough is over $1,100 per employee citywide. For Hillsborough, personnel costs that I've referred to represent 75 to 80% of the budget. And as a consequence of ballot measure 50, we all know that the city can only increase its revenue by 3% a year unless the economy miraculously turns around or Washington County denies Intel's various requests with respect to the valuation of property and economic development-driven initiatives. The financial policymakers, the budget committees of the cities and counties throughout Oregon, face a very similar and harsh economic reality. Some of our counties, some of our cities have bonded the PERS indebtedness that needs to be paid, starting with the PERS increases that take effect this year. The tension is painfully apparent. Do we balance how do we balance service levels and funding priorities? We think we understand what the law means. We're not happy with it. If we, as I point out in the point paper, if we had the opportunity to change the law, we would reinforce even more the priority to be given to interest and welfare of the public and the funding and budgetary decisions of local government. But if the arbitrator, if the city's finances truly reflect an inability to pay or a limited ability to pay, the ability of labor interests at interest arbitration under the revised language proposed in this bill have a much easier time on a playing field which is tilted in their favor by this proposed amendment with respect to how the interest arbitrator is going to decide fiscal issues that are on the table. So if it were up to the cities, the counties, the special districts, those who employ firefighters and police officers, they would seek a fix of a very opposite character and restrict even more the authority of arbitrators to second-guess their funding decisions in this time. Lord knows, the state of Washington had done so for many years. The state troopers were among those in Washington who had no access to interest arbitration, and they bargained with the legislature every year. The change in Section 4F of eliminating overall compensation writes out of the bill the arbitrator's focus on PERS, the arbitrator's focus on health care costs, because we're shifting away from language that talks about overall compensation. The deletion of a reference to the all cities CPI, a very correct, right-headed, common-sense decision of the Legislative Assembly, of Professor Drummond's, and the governor in Senate Bill 750, will usher in significant litigation at the bargaining. It's significant litigation when the parties can't agree which of the many indices of the Bureau of Labor, of the federal BLS, we ought to be using for our COLA. And some advantage labor significantly, others are balanced, are far more balanced. The comparability, in conclusion on this issue and this bill, the comparability change suggested by labor is significant, and that's in 4F of the bill. What we have had during the last 2.5 years are three arbitration decisions in which arbitrators have given weight to the extraordinary good lawyering of my colleague, Professor Mike Tedesco at the University of Oregon, who represents the IAFF in Oregon. He has done an exemplary job for labor, and he has created that a fiction that comparability can be a one-way street and not reciprocal. And so we have three decisions in which arbitrators told the cities of Ashland, Grants Pass, Astoria, and one other city that because of their population in the 10,000 range, they were in fact comparable to Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, one of the largest fire departments in the Pacific Northwest, because TVFNR serves cities of like population: Sherwood, Wilsonville, Banks. Well, Banks is too far out. There's another one or two, but I've made the point. TVFNR or Gresham or Clackamas 1, who serve smaller cities within the Portland metropolitan area, firefighters in Portland would never dream of comparing themselves for wage comparability purposes to firefighters employed in the city fire departments of Pendleton or any of the other cities. And yet, that's what the arbitrator did. We've had other arbitrations go the other way. In conclusion, let me say that That issue, like others, underscores the point at which I began my testimony, which is the split in interest ARBs, the split in grievance ARBs, the split in decisions by the Employment Relations Board is right at 50-50. And I can't emphasize enough, Chairman Posansky and members of the committee, I cannot emphasize enough that this is not a system that's broken. We are here today because once, and we will be here again when one side or the other, could be management, seeks to gain relative advantage over the other more than the bargain that was struck when the legislature devoted all the time and energy that it did to Senate Bill 750. And if everybody's a little bit unhappy, then everybody's a little bit happy and or could be a little bit happy. And if I were the public policy maker, you know, I would adopt my wife's kindergarten teacher philosophy about this kind of thing, not entertain bills of this nature and not entertain the party's behavior in coming back to the legislature to seek advantage over these kinds of issues. And I'll look forward to speaking with you further later this afternoon about the remaining two.
Thank you. Whoever wants to go next.
Chairman Posansky and members of the committee, I'm Scott Lazenby. I'm the city manager for the city of Sandy. We're a city of 6,600 folks next to Mount Hood. I'm also representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm the vice president of the Oregon City and County Managers Association, and also speaking on behalf of my colleagues who have to deal with these kinds of issues daily. I don't want to talk in any depth on the particulars that Mr. Blitz has covered. I agree with his summary of the negative aspects. In general, this is just a bad bill. Three areas, particularly the in paragraph four, reducing the priority placed on the interest and welfare of the public. I don't understand why the unions would be seeking that. My friends in the police and fire services get into that profession to advance the benefit and welfare of the public. That's why they do those jobs. In paragraph in C, 4C, taking out the language that would allow the arbitrator to give due consideration and weight to the other services provided by the unit of government. It's insane not to have the arbitrator able to look at those things. Any reasonable person would, and it makes no sense whatsoever to take that out of the law. And then finally, as Aiken mentioned, the comparability issue. It's already been stretched in the ridiculous extents, and this would just open up the doors by saying the arbitrator can include similar communities, but basically doesn't have to, and can include, by extension, communities that really have no relationship whatsoever to the one that's going through arbitration. So I'll just keep it brief and end here unless you have questions.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Miles Ward. I'm a lawyer, assistant city attorney with the city of Gresham. I've been a lawyer in Oregon for more than 25 years and have dealt with a number of these issues over those years. I'm going to try to be very brief. Interest arbitration is where employees go to get more money. That's the way it works. Arbitrators listen to both sides, and under the current state of the law, then picks one of the last best offers. What Senate Bill 319 seems to do is to take out a few of the components that an arbitrator can consider, and those components that are to be eliminated under this bill are just those few that have historically been somewhat favorable to management. And that seems to me to be both artificial and wrong. Specifically, I'd like to address, from a practical point of view, that in making a choice between the two last best offers, Senate Bill 319 removes the current requirement that an arbitrator give consideration or weight to the other services that are provided by the unit of government and the service priorities that have been established by local elected officials in the budget process. My question is this: how can any arbitrator fairly evaluate an employer's last best offer without giving due consideration to the competing priorities that the local elected officials had to take into consideration when they established their budget? That's the primary practical objection I have to Senate Bill 319. Thank you.
What? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Watt. Today I'm representing Jackson County. First of all, I need to make it clear that I'm not a lawyer. I have never bargained a contract, but I have had the pleasure of negotiating with Dr. Henry Drummond on Senate Bill 750.
I was going to say, you actually got to vote on 750.
Yes, sir. I did ultimately, and there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that was laid on the floor prior to that vote, I might say. Management didn't get everything it wanted. We negotiated in good faith over an extended period of time on that piece of legislation. I can't speak for the labor side, but representing the management side, we met with our people on a frequent basis, and we came back and we laid their concerns and thoughts on the table and ultimately resulted in Senate Bill 750. I will agree with my colleagues at the table and not elaborate, but if changes need to be made to the Collective Bargaining Act, certainly I believe that they should take place in a global structure as opposed to a piecemeal approach, which we see here. I would only say, in voicing Jackson County's opposition to the bill, that the interest and welfare of the public is really the only factor that taxpayers care about. So I'll conclude my remarks. I'm open for questions, and thank you for the opportunity to testify here today.
Thank you. We'll start with questions. Senator Whitson.
Chair Brzezinski, Mr. Watt. As legislator, you know that the primary charge of our oath of office as legislator is to act in the best interest and welfare of the public, of the people of the state. So in your opinion, how would passage of this bill, as it's currently worded, comport with that charge?
Again, stressing that I'm not an attorney, just from our position at Jackson County, the effect could be on the ability of the county to be able to provide or continue to provide the services that it provides the people right now, and seriously put that in danger given the other financial impacts that we're dealing with as a county today.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. That's all that I have on the first list that was turned in for Senate Bill 319. I'm going to give an opportunity for first to see if there's another list that's been anyone's entered their name for 319. It appears not. Is there anyone else that wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 319? Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 319. And at this time, we're going to go ahead and move into Senate Bill 320. And I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 320. And it looks to me that we're going to have pretty much the repeat of the first panel. So if you want to come back up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
And before you get started, I know I'm going to hear this afterwards. I want to give Ms. Braun her opportunity to tell us a little about 320, since I didn't give her the opportunity to do it on 319.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Senate Bill 320 removes the public safety officer from definition of supervisory employee in public collective bargaining law if they merely assign, transfer, or direct work of other employees, but have no authority to impose economic discipline on those employees.
Mr. Livingston.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And I think you'll see the same pattern as you did before. I'll be brief again in my testimony. Senate Bill 320 is a bill that would simply allow clarity with respect to how you define a bargaining unit employee. One of the fundamental changes, once again, that occurred during the 1995 session was it broadened the definitions of how an employee can be determined to be supervisory. What this bill does, despite what some people may say, this bill is not about trying to add fire chiefs and police chiefs or their executive officers to the bargaining unit. What this does do is to try to attempt to add clarity to the statutes that would allow team leaders such as a fire captain or a fire lieutenant and those individuals to continue to maintain their status in the bargaining unit. One of the things that's difficult about this, and we have had discussions with employers in previous years, is that you simply can't use a definition such as a fire lieutenant or a fire captain, because one of the things that you have problems with is that's different to many jurisdictions. It's different than a fire lieutenant is than a police lieutenant. And so what you need to do is you need to construct language that really clarifies what those duties are, irrespective of what your title is. And what we're asking for in this is to simply those individuals that are our team leader, somebody that works on the front lines and is doing things as a team leader and not necessarily providing ultimate direction as far as managerial decisions and the like, they should not be precluded. Unfortunately, what we have seen since the inception and passage of Senate Bill 715 for 2 years, we've seen a slow deterioration of people that used to be in bargaining units. To be quite honest, where we're seeing it most is we're seeing it in some of our smaller bargaining units where they're slowly starting to take a fire captain or a fire lieutenant out of the bargaining unit. And I know Brian will give some specifics from the law enforcement side. Clearly, these people do not make decisions as whether they fire an individual or even setting policy. It's their duty to basically enforce policy. And so this is our attempt to try to really protect those individuals. And the one thing that I think is clear is certainly with some of the changes that you made last session with the PERS, what we have seen, quite honestly, Mr. Chair and committee members, is we have seen a significant brain drain on people that would normally have more time to become mid-level managers or even, you know, potentially a fire chief or some of those type of positions. And what we have seen, though, is now we're in a position to where, to be quite honest with you, I have friends on both the police and fire service side that have elected to stop at a level on whatever the determination of the bargaining unit and not take some of those positions purely because of the new definition of how they apply supervisory. Some of the issues and concerns of why they don't do that is it's simply you don't have as much protection as you do when you have a bargaining contract. And so what we have seen, and it is a current concern to my constituents, is that traditional people now are being pulled out of that, and what you in effect have seen is where people stop at the lowest level to where they get to maintain. And as we've seen an erosion of where that level is, it does cause us concerns. And all we're simply trying to do, and I'll just reemphasize again, we're not here, and I think you may hear people say that fire chiefs and deputy chiefs would be in the bargaining units. I can assure you that the members I represent, if that was what we were intending to do, I probably would not be liked very well when I go back to discuss with them what that is. So this, the intent of this, simply the traditional bargaining units and go back to that definition.
For the record, again, Brian DeLashment representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the other ones that I mentioned on 319. Let me digress for just a very brief moment. I was taken by the abbreviated testimony of the panel that came up here before. I've heard attorneys talk before, but that was not what I would consider abbreviated. But there was three comments that were made that struck me, and struck me pretty hard. One was a comment that, in a quote, incursion into management's rights. I believe, and I think our members believe, that the collective bargaining system is a balance between everybody's rights. And these bills are being portrayed as an incursion into management's rights. And that struck me a little bit harsh on what the bills actually are intended to do. I think they really are intended to be a balance. And in, as I had indicated on 319, the balance that we were seeking was a balance for the arbiter to be able to make a decision based upon all of the criteria, not just one criteria, not being able to get past that. And so for it to be portrayed as an incursion into management's rights, I think, is a little bit of a misrepresentation. The second comment that I had was, interest arbitration is where employees go to get money. Well, I thought interest arbitration was a place where the employer and the employees go when there's not an agreement on a collective bargaining agreement and they have no ability to strike. This arbitration system was set up so that public safety officers who are not allowed to strike have a way to resolve their dispute with the employer. And let me assure you, it is not all about money. If you have ever looked at an arbitration, there is a whole variety of issues, all the way from, you know, health care, salaries, of course, are a component of it, but there are a whole variety of things in that. It may be 20, 30, 50, 100 components. Salary is just one component, and in many cases, an employee, when bargaining and putting together a final last best offer, has to balance all the rest of those things against the component of wage increases. So again, to say interest arbitration is where employees go for money, I think is a gross oversimplification of what the process is all about. And the third one is, I keep hearing that there was negotiations around Senate Bill 750. Well, by God, none of us were at the table on 750. I don't know who the hell they were negotiating with, but it wasn't us. They were negotiating with Henry Drummond's in the governor's office. And if they lost something to Henry Drummond's, I'm sorry. Did we lose a lot in those negotiations? Yes, because we're not participants in those discussions. And so for the portrayal that there was this balanced negotiation over what the final outcome of 750 was going to be and all the players were at the table is not an accurate representation of what happened. I apologize for the digression. Let me go to 320 now. 320, as Bob has indicated, is a very simplistic way to get back to really dealing with the difference between a supervisor and a lead worker. Bob's talked about fire service. In police service, you're really talking about primarily the sergeants in this case. But we have a number of situations in which a police officer may be excluded from a bargaining unit because they have any ability at all to influence decisions about hiring, firing, or economics. And let me give you a couple of examples. You've all seen the old cop shows about the veteran cop and the rookie cop. Okay? So you put a rookie cop with a veteran cop and they're partners. And at some point in that process, somebody asks the veteran police officer, how's he doing? Can you write us something about that would give us some perspective on their ability to function, what they need to improve in, so forth? Under this definition, the current definition of 750, we truly believe that those people can be excluded from a bargaining unit. Because they are, although they're not working as a supervisor, they in fact are working as a traditional lead worker, and under the current definition of 750, could in fact be excluded from bargaining units. We have the situation in which, in many cases, there are panels of veteran officers that interview prospective employees and can give input on whether or not they believe this employee would be a good officer. Well, again, under current 750, it is very likely that an employer could in fact contend that this person, although not a traditional supervisor, has the ability to somehow influence their employment status and therefore is a supervisor and could be excluded from a bargaining unit. And with that, I'll cut short my comments. I don't want to run on and on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Daniel Swift. I am president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. We feel this bill is very important for a couple of reasons. One, Bob's already spoken to about the brain drain in the state service. I have talked with many, many members who would probably be the best choice to move up to supervision, yet deliberately, intentionally choose not to, simply because they do not want to work without the protections that the association gives, both under the PDCBA, Legal Defense Fund, and other issues that provide them protection and feel that will protect their families for the decision they make. Now, what we're talking about here is not management, and we're not trying to get management, and management shouldn't be in a labor union. However, we are talking about supervision, first-line supervision, which is traditionally neither fish nor fowl, or in many ways can be both. Rarely do supervisors actually have total ability to hire and fire. They can provide input, but they don't have authority to hire and fire. They can initiate, and often will and should initiate, initial investigations. But the decisions as to what level of discipline are taken at the chief's level or lieutenant's level or command staff level. They are not taken at the sergeant's level. What this does is this allows sergeants to be what they are, or excuse me, not, I shouldn't use the term sergeant because we get caught up in titles, supervisors who are true and direct frontline supervision to make the decisions that they're allowed to make, still work the field because they are expected to go out and do a certain percentage of patrolling, law enforcement, hands-on activity, and give them the protection they're required to, they really should need and out there on the street. And finally, it also gives them basically what all of us really want in many ways, which is an ability to associate with whomever we want to or groups that we want to. They're not management. They should be allowed to, at least, rather than an arbitrary decision, you're excluded, give them the opportunity to pick and choose in their own group, for their own agency, for their own department, what works best for them, and decide as a group, do we want to belong with the union or do we not? Right now, they don't have that choice. They're simply gone. And this at least would give them the choice. They may vote not to, or in that agency, it's better not to. But the choice is now theirs, and that's the employee who's actually out there providing the service, and it's just given that right to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you very much. It seems to me that you've got a continuum where somebody may have somewhat of a supervisory role, a little bit, and suddenly they become management, and that's all they do. It's just not a fine line where you cross it and you're there. And, I've looked ahead a little bit at some of the testimony that I think we're going to hear in opposition to this bill, and it seems to me that is their concern, that you're going to have management that's going to be involved in members. I mean, how do you resolve that? How do you resolve the fact that it is a continuum and it's not just a bright line?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, that argument has been brought up in previous sessions, and what we've asked is, if that's the concern of the opposition to these bills, then they supply us with some language that they believe is much more clear-cut and does in fact delineate those folks that are truly managers from those people that in fact are truly lead workers. What we attempted to do with this bill is go back to what was the more traditional definition prior to 750 of who was a manager, who was a supervisor, who was a lead worker. And that's what this language does. In essence, goes back to pre-750. Well, prior to 750 passing, you didn't have managers, chiefs, captains, and so on down the list being parts of bargaining units. So I don't understand their argument. I hear what they're saying. But if they have a better solution to solve our problem of who in fact is really a lead worker versus a supervisor, I'm more than open to that discussion, but this has been going on for 4 years, and I haven't heard their proposed language that solves our problem.
Okay.
Follow up, Mr. Chair? Right.
I guess is what I'm wondering is there a dispute in at the core of it, is there a dispute in concept about what you want versus what they want, or is there just a dispute about what language will get us there? Maybe we're not sure.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I guess I'm unclear. I haven't heard that there is a dispute as far as the core element of them wanting lead workers, and we think lead workers are being excluded. If that's what they really want to have done, then a continuation of the existing statute is probably their preference. If they, in fact, really want to delineate between those people that are lead workers and those people that are supervisors, there may be some language that can be. And if you note on the bill, just for an example, I did represent the Oregon Nurses Association when 750 was going through. through. And if you were to look at page 4, line 13.
Of which bill now?
Of 320. There's a lot of parallels here to one of my other clients, and that's nursing. A nurse on a staffing floor supervises a lot of people, but they're not supervisors.
Right.
There are nursing assistants, there's techs, there's radiology techs, there's a whole variety of people, but they're not supervisors. But if you're a police officer and you were to do that same kind of thing, you in fact would be a supervisor and been excluded from a bargaining unit.
Okay. Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Yep.
Since Mr. DeLashmet digressed and went back to Senate Bill 319. Mr. Chair, is it okay if I do the same for a moment?
Sure.
Okay. Just for a moment. I mean, I've heard your argument, and then I heard theirs, but I'd kind of like to hear your response, too. I was particularly interested in and I'm sorry I missed much of the initial testimony, so maybe you already said this, but what's the reason to move away from including PERS and healthcare costs in the analysis, in the comparison? Did you say that and I just missed it?
I think I'll take a shot at that for the record, Bob Livingston. Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, that's not our interpretation of that. We don't believe that it does that. I think they have made those assumptions that that does it, but what that clearly is not the intention, nor do we believe that's what it is. We believe that overall compensation, that you can say the same thing, wages, hours, and conditions of employment.
But the words,
certainly.
The words conditions of employment, you think include PERS and include health care costs?
Well, certainly. And as an example, part of your wages is included in the PERS pickup. And so certainly we believe that that encapsulated that. And if I could, I would also mention that I think there's a little bit of a fallacy on the elimination of the interest and welfare of the public, in that you have to exclude other portions of government. If you look on line 12 of the bill, it says the interest and welfare of the public and the reasonable financial ability of the unit of government to meet the costs of the proposed contract. There's two types of units of governments typically at the local level. Obviously, states is obvious. You have a fire district or a special district, or you have a municipality. There's nothing in this language that I interpret that would eliminate a city coming forward and saying, for example, they're all part of a unit of government. They provide library services, they provide public works, they provide police and fire. Nothing in this language, to my knowledge, would eliminate them making the arguments for that total package on them providing services to their community.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Well, I'm going to go ahead and ask the panel that was up before in opposition to 319, who's also listed here for 320, to please come up. I know that Mr. Cock and Mr. Carter want to give testimony in favor, but I'm going to go ahead and try to keep some type of rhythm here that we've got going. Mr. Blitz, are you going to start off again?
I believe so.
Okay.
Senator Pozanski, members of the committee, I do not want to start off by rebutting the points which have previously been made.
I think that's probably best. I'm giving some latitude because, as I mentioned at the very beginning, I've got members coming and going. What I expect, based on what I've heard so far, I probably am going to have a work group that's going to be working through all three of these first initial bills, and so we may need to flesh some of that out at that time.
If I may take literally a second or two in response to Senator Ringo's question, it was an excellent one, and I would say only Chairman Pozanski and Senator Ringo that pre-Senate Bill 750, Oregonians, both labor and management, had invested enormous resources in litigating and creating a bank of interest arbitration decisions that were cited by the parties and relied upon in precedent and served as guideposts for decisions that are made at the collective bargaining process. I can't stress enough how much I fear tinkering with the law. It's because we're going to start all over again. And the representatives of labor, police officers and firefighters, aren't in my world of dealing with lawyers and writing briefs. Senator Pozanski, I'm sure, can appreciate particularly the value of the precedent. And I just hate to lose that by redefining without any legislative intent and without a clear mandate and without clear understandings. If labor reads their bill one way, I certainly read it very differently. With respect to the supervisory employee, attached to my testimony is a chart of the numerous factors which go into the decision that the Employment Relations Board makes as to whether a particular person is acting in a supervisory capacity or not. That said, I'm not sure whether I can share light on the question posed by Brian DeLashmet in his testimony, but I can say this. The situation with respect to law enforcement is very, very different than the fire service. So let's start with fire. The fire chiefs, special districts, the fire districts have no problem with legislation that would make clear, in the words of the prior witnesses, that battalion chiefs are managerial employees with a set of administrative and management-related duties. They would have no problem with a presumption in the law, a rebuttable presumption in the law, I should say, which makes clear that management shouldn't be raiding fire bargaining units and putting lieutenants and captains in the exempt supervisory category, even though they are supervisors for many purposes. Many fire departments, it's the lieutenant or the captain that runs the entire shift. But usually, it's the battalion chief who is, in essence, the battalion commander with each engine company with a company grade officer, either a lieutenant or a captain. And pretty uniformly throughout Oregon, in my experience, the lieutenants and the captains are in the bargaining unit. They are lead workers, and they operate in an environment. The point I want to make about the two services, when you deploy a young baby firefighter to a complicated situation, he goes with his company officer and either another one, two, or three firefighters, depending on how the apparatus is staffed in a particular fire department. When we send a young rookie police officer out on the street alone in a police car, he's operating in a very different environment with little or no supervision directly, and the cultures of the department make an immeasurable difference. And if the police chief doesn't have the loyalty, the support, and the undivided loyalty and the undivided support of the supervisors who are supervising folks on the street, we will wind up with morale problems. We will wind up unable to police the police. We will wind up, in short, with the kinds of situations that create public media focus that, you know, has plagued the Portland Police Bureau over the last several years. We just litigated for 3 days in the city of Hillsborough the question of whether Hillsborough sergeants should be in the bargaining unit. They are today non-represented supervisory employees.
Mr. Chairman, may I just ask a question about that?
Yes.
Was that litigation, did it turn around the question of our current statute and the definition of how you said it was a police sergeant, where the police sergeant fell in terms of the statute?
Senator Przanski, Senator Ringo, yes, it did. We operated under the current statute, and there is no decision because after several days of testimony, the union withdrew its petition in that case.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. I mean, it just seems to me that ambiguity means the legislature didn't do its job earlier because it left the ambiguity, which led to the litigation, and there must be some way to satisfy the concerns of labor in this case and do it in a way so that we don't continue the ambiguities that will give rise to those kinds of lawsuits.
Senator Przanski, if I may, Senator Ringo, the issue has less to do with ambiguity in the statute. I think the practitioners can read it. We understand it. The litigation arises not over an interpretation of the law, but rather about the facts in a specific police department. So labor has one view in the city of Sandy, and may have one view in the city of Sandy, for example, where there's where at a very different view in the city of Portland.
I see. Okay.
I'd like to continue.
I would. Thank you very much, Senator Brzezinski. The point that was most salient, there are many more in the written testimony, the single point that was most salient is this. Chief Louis has high expectations of his police officers and his sergeants. The culture is driven from the top down. The chief communicates with employees through the sergeants. The sergeants are their bosses of their shift. The sergeants are the role models for young officers. The sergeants are in a position to make sure that bad things don't happen as a result of the way young, inexperienced, recently hired police officers are conducting policing. But most important, it is by design that sergeants do not have authority to impose economic discipline. None of the witnesses here seem to understand this critical element, and I will share with you that I suspect that a good many police administrators do not share the level of enlightenment of the police administration in the city of Hillsborough. But the fact is that sergeants are not asked to initiate economic discipline because it is incredibly time-consuming. We've got to deal with lawyers. We've got to deal with due process procedures. We've got to write a notice. We've got to write disciplinary letters. We've got to meet with the union. We've got to conduct a disciplinary investigation in a manner which comports with labor law and a host of other, and the labor contract and the policies and procedures. It's complicated. It's desk work. It requires a lot of time. It's high-risk, high-litigation-prone activity that doesn't happen very often. The chief, by design, says that kind of activity is best engaged by a lieutenant or a captain who supports the shift but is a supervisor at a very different level, at a managerial level, as opposed to an exempt supervisor at the line level. If you were to listen to Gordon Graham of the California Highway Patrol, he would talk ad nauseum about all the bad things that can happen in policing on the street and how it is that it is the sergeant on the radio, the sergeant responding to the difficult calls that trains, guides, mentors, establishes the values of policing and makes sure that police officers on the street are delivering service in a manner which is in keeping with the values and directives of the police chief, but more importantly, the city council and the city manager. And what you have in your materials is a witness affidavit of Chief Louis explaining why the supervisory issue is critical beyond expression to the law enforcement community. This issue is one of a high order in magnitude.
Mr. Blitz, let me ask you a question regarding that. I'm familiar with how the Eugene Police Department works since I'm on the police commission, and I serve as a prosecutor and work for that at their municipal court and also in the DA's office, and now do other work for other cities. My understanding is that the coaches that they use in their framework are not just exclusively sergeants. They assign people as they first come out, sometimes in Baker units and then on their own with some type of shadowing and stuff like that, and that the sergeants basically are taking care of the administrative work for that shift and making some critical decisions as necessary when they need to have that input. Am I hearing that what Hillsborough does is different from that?
Senator Brzezinski, thank you. No, you are not.
Okay.
Hillsborough has FTOs, field training officers, who are trained and certified as such, and whose responsibility it is to train in the field after a police officer goes to the DPSST Academy. He returns and works with an FTO. In Hillsborough, an officer will work with at least three FTOs. They evaluate what is done on a daily and weekly basis. The intensity of the oversight is significant. It is the FTO training program is part of the selection process. When a recruit is cut loose from FTO status, that does not transform a 21 or 23 year old with no military experience and maybe an AA degree into a seasoned veteran police officer who knows the answer to every question and can make the right judgments. And you've seen, I'm sure, in your work in conjunction, Senator Pruszynski, with the Eugene Police Department, some of the files about the mistakes and errors that are potential and the extreme enormity of some of them. I think our point is that if we're interested in protecting civil rights and obeying the law and getting more arrests and good searches, we need to have loyal sergeants doing the work of the police chief and one-on-one supervision in the field, and that's what is being done in Hillsborough.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share with us on 320? Because I am looking at the time. I want to make sure the rest of the panel has opportunity to speak. And if there's other questions, we have a couple more on this, and we have two more bills.
Happy to answer any questions the committee has. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. Gentlemen, anything else that you'd like to add on Senate Bill 320?
No. Just one real brief
thing. If you could just identify yourself.
Yes, for the record, Scott Lasmy, City Manager, City of Sandy. You know, this does affect Hillsborough, OSP, and other big agencies, but most police departments in the state of Oregon are the size of ours in Sandy. We've got 7 officers, 2 sergeants, and a chief. And for us, this criterion of economic discipline would be fairly useless. We have an outstanding staff. In my 13 years as city manager, have never had to impose economic discipline on a police officer. The chief has that authority, but he would certainly, if he had to do it, would do it in consultation with the sergeants. On the other hand, the sergeants deal with authorizing overtime, denying vacation, setting shifts, engaging in other disciplinary measures. They work with me and the chief on establishing the department's budget and deploying staff. In a city like ours, they really are management. They are called sergeants. They are on the street with the officers too in a small town. But again, this is the model for the police departments in most cities in our state at our level. Our sergeants themselves, we have one of them was the former president of the police union. The other was on the bargaining team for the police union, and they would agree that they should not now be in the bargaining unit now that they are part of the management team of the department.
Senator Pruszynski, if I may just add one point in light of that one, and it is simply this, that many of the clients I represent are small cities in and around Oregon. City managers routinely reserve to themselves decisions about economic discipline. So even the police chief, under this test, in a number of jurisdictions, even the police chief would not be a supervisor.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. And I have 2 other people who wanted to, I believe, give testimony on 320, J.C. Cock and Roy Carter. If you want to give testimony on 320.
It should have been 321.
321. I see you on that list, too, so we'll make sure that you get there. Is there anyone else that's in the room that wanted to give testimony at this time on 320? Not seeing anyone. We're going to close the public hearing on 320. At this time, I'm going to be opening up a public hearing on 321. And let's start with the first panel as the likely suspects. Yes, thank you very much. Keep me off. I'm in trouble.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 321 modifies the definition of employment relations in public collective bargaining for employees who are prohibited from striking to include staffing levels and safety issues that have a potential impact on the job safety and workload for employees.
Well,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And before I start, let me just make one real quick comment so that there's everybody's clear, and particularly for those individuals that may be watching this at home. Irrespective of any labor management issues that go on, I can assure you that the citizens of Oregon are always being well served. And in my experience, and my colleagues that are here today, when the bells ring or when the call comes in for a police officer, whatever the differences are that labor management has, I can tell you that 100% assurity, professionalism is always in mind, and we take care of business. And so I think that's important to note that for people that are out there and watching this, and in case there's some dispersions on if there's some big argument going over labor management's disputes, it simply doesn't happen. We all recognize the importance of making sure that we maintain public safety. Senate Bill 321 could arguably be one of the most important bills, if not the most important bills of the three. What this simply does is one of the things, once again, 10 years ago, and you're seeing the pattern, they changed the issues of what are determined to be mandatory subject to bargaining and which ones are permissive. Under the current statutory scheme, in order for a safety item to be determined to be a mandatory subject, you must show that there is a direct and substantial effect on the job safety. While this initially could be construed as a very subtle change that occurred in 1995, the reality of it is this has been a huge substantive change. The Employment Relations Board, who makes determinations on whether a subject's mandatory or permissive, has ruled early on that in order for a police officer or firefighter union to even discuss safety issues at the bargaining table, they must determine its effect in order to determine its bargaining status. And let me just read that, because I think that's a really important element and why you see we have a problem. Employment Relations Board has made it clear that under the current statutory scheme, when the subject of a proposal concerns safety, staffing, or workload, we are required to determine its effect in order to determine its bargaining status. Well, in our business, that means, and in effect means, that's, to be quite honestly, that simply could mean waiting for an officer to get shot, could be waiting for a firefighter to be burned up in a building or a collapse. And we think that in order to be proactive and have discussions on that, it's appropriate that this should be part of a discussion that you have at the bargaining table. It's ironic that an electrician, a plumber, other tradesmen under NLRB have the ability to discuss safety issues with their employers while they're negotiating, but the very essence of your public safety officers do not have that ability. I know that many opponents of the bill will cry foul and say that this is not the place to discuss those issues, and that this bill and this element of the change in the statute would be too costly, unnecessary, or speculative, but I think I need to take you back just ever so briefly to some of the previous discussions that we had, and the most important safeguard that employers have is twofold. One, last final best offer. If employees or labor organizations want to even discuss a safety issue, and let's say they think it's a good idea, they still have to have the ability to have that close in respect to a financial ability to pay because of the overarching issue of a last final best offer. As I noted before, it's either all or nothing. And so what we believe is that that's an additional safeguard that employers have when you're asking for a last final best offer. And if you go back and look at the arbitrations, they do look closely at the ability to pay. We all recognize that times are tough financially. There's been property tax limitations and other things that have reduced the revenue streams. But in our opinion, nothing is more important than the safety of our public safety officers and having good conversations with the people that are out there on the front lines. That's simply what this bill will do. And that safeguard of the last final best offer requires them to be reasonable in their discussion. Further, if we feel strongly enough about a safety issue, then arguably, in order to attain that, we may very well have to give up a lesser benefit in health care, freeze on wages in order to realize that. But my point of that is shouldn't that be a decision that your frontline public safety officers should make and not management? And with that, I would just conclude with the dynamics of it have changed within public safety, even since 1995 when they eliminated our ability to talk safety. Not only in the fire service are we having to address issues such as your basic firefighting techniques and your emergency medical calls, but now in this day and age we have to have training in weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, confined space rescue, trench rescue, and to think that we can rely on either a safety meeting to bring up those or even OSHA, who mandates safety for all industries, to think that they're the experts that we can turn to tell the police and fire service what to do is simply not true. OSHA, if you would look at the OSHA standards, there's very minimal standards that they have in place for your public safety officers due to the complexities that we have. And so we think it's appropriate for your frontline firefighters and police officers to be able to discuss safety. And it's simply nothing more, nothing less than to meet and confer. This does not impose the will of the union. It just simply says, hey, both sides should be able to discuss this and not simply just one, whether they want to or not.
Thank you.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, again, representing the previously mentioned employees. I'll be extremely brief. There's nothing more important, besides obviously the protection of the public, that police officers take to heart than their own personal safety. And their families are always concerned about their own personal safety. For an employer, and I know you're going to hear from the employer representatives, that any good employer representative would not deny the ability for a discussion around safety issues. Well, I would tell you that that's probably a majority of the cases. You have employers that say, yeah, we'll talk about safety issues, and it's not a mandatory subject, it's a voluntary or permissive subject, and that's all well and good. But there are employers in this state that, just because they have the ability to say, no, I don't want to talk about safety issues, and I have that prerogative because it's not a mandatory subject, you have jurisdictions that do not talk about safety. And again, for a public safety officer to be blocked statutorily from requiring their employer to talk to them about issues that are of the utmost most importance to them, I believe is insulting to a police officer when they go out on the street. I cannot express to you any harder, any firmer, that this is the issue that when I go out and talk to my folks about, that really gets them in the gut. They say, what can we do about our ability to talk about safety? Because our employers do not have to talk about it, and in some cases, they don't want to talk about it. And with that, I'll end my testimony. You're going to hear, again, as Bob has indicated, well, this opens up Pandora's box for, you know, price tags and discussions about anything. All of the issues that he's talked about, the balancing act, the arbiter has to go through, the balancing act, that the employees, when they put their final best offer together as a package, has to be balanced. And they, in fact, in that case, are bargaining against themselves. They have to give up, whether it's health care, they have to give up wages, and if they feel that strongly about a particular safety issue that they're willing to do that, then why shouldn't they be allowed to do that? Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Daniel Swift, president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. Basically, the core of this issue, this is what this comes down to, is this is our lives on the line. We're the ones that are going out there having to deliver the point of service, and it's our lives that are being put in jeopardy, nobody else's. Many agencies are very enlightened and allow different methods for us to negotiate with them. Others do not. And if a public safety member is denied that opportunity to bargain, what other avenue does that person have? They can't necessarily go to the city council or state legislature or county commissioners without potentially running afoul of disciplinary action for insubordination. Oregon OSHA, while it does its job, is certainly not a protection for us. It just flat out isn't. Not in the times that we have to respond to issues which are very threatening to us. What this all this does is allow us to bargain. Bargain does not mean dictate. Bargain does not mean we get. It means that they have to sit down and talk to us and listen to us and hear us on our concerns. It cannot and will not bog down the bargaining process because we can throw a bunch of things in there we want, but under 750, the clock is running. If we're not making any progress or the other side feels that the labor is delaying things, the clock's running. 150 days, it's set for arbitration. So, and none of this takes away from the arbitration. As my two colleagues point out, it doesn't change that we have to submit a last best final offer. So all this does is provide a mechanism for the people who are actually out there doing the job, whose lives are the ones that are at risk and who will pay the ultimate price if their safety equipment fails, to sit down and formally bring the other side to the table and discuss the issues with us and make them listen to us. Doesn't mean we get it. Just means they have to listen to us and gives us a mechanism. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Gentlemen, thank you again. And let's see if we can have the first panel. I've got here on 321, Scott, Aiken, Miles, and John. I don't know if you wanted to come up on this one or not.
Senator Pozanski, Senator Whitsitt. Again, for the record, I'm Aiken Blitz. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Public Employers mentioned previously and the sheriffs, fire chiefs, and police chiefs associations. What I heard and what I understood the previous testimony to be was that it's the firefighters and the police officers on the line who are in the best position to make decisions about their own safety. What I didn't hear was a recognition of my experience sitting at the bargaining table and working with police chiefs and fire chiefs throughout Oregon. Amazingly, many of them have previously served as union presidents. They have all served as police officers and firefighters. I don't believe there's a fire chief anywhere in the state who has not served as a firefighter. They understand safety just as well as, if not significantly better than, their rank and file employees. I also heard one of the, and I'm not sure exactly which witness it was, state that we just want an opportunity to talk about it. It doesn't mean that we get it. City and county and special district objections to 321 have nothing to do with the notion that we shouldn't talk about safety, that we shouldn't be cognizant of safety issues, and that we should not work collaboratively with regard to safety issues, because indeed we should, and we do. The concern is that if we change safety and staffing to become mandatory subjects of bargaining, then by operation of law, it's no longer we just get to talk about it. It's not only do we talk about it, we can't change midterm any practice, any policy that relates to these mandatory subjects. We can't make a decision and implement it, no matter how urgent, unless the union ignores it. We have to give them notice of the change in the mandatory subject. We have to bargain about the change midterm. And if we don't agree, management would say under the current statute that we get to implement. Unions would say under the current statute we have to arbitrate. I'm not sure what the answer is. I just know that it's unworkable, fundamentally unworkable. Senate Bill 321 amends the definition of employment relations to include safe staffing levels and safety issues that have a potential impact on safety and workload. Safety and workload. Workload's never been part of the Senate Bill 750 mix. That's certainly huge to teachers. It was certainly a huge issue to the Portland firefighters who are asked to leave the station and perform some ancillary duties in the course of their shift. And it will be a big issue a centerpiece for bargaining demands if the law changes in this area. And bargaining demands translate to distraction for the management team, distraction for the employees, and a current state of bargaining relating to these issues. Because in public safety particularly, where the jobs we'll all acknowledge are potentially and inherently dangerous, every issue is potentially has an impact on safety. And in the words of the previous witnesses, indeed, cities and counties, labor or management representatives do see this as a Pandora's box. The effect of this bill is limited to the strike prohibited employees. So when there's an issue about safety, when there's an issue about staffing that has a potential nexus, then the parties are going to bargain because the statute commands that they do so. One or the other is going to abandon their position, or they're going to arbitrate to get a decision of a third party. And I would submit to you that while some labor arbitrators have expertise in some things, entrusting to labor arbitrators with no experience in the shop of policing and the shop of fire suppression and EMS is not the best way to protect the interests of our firefighters. Let me say a little bit about safety and then turn briefly to staffing. The real issue for labor practitioners has little to do with safety. The real issue in this bill has everything to do with strategy. This is very much, for me, a welcome to my world sort of window, because I see every day bargaining positions and bargaining requests that are brought to the table under the auspices of, we want to talk about it, it's a safety issue. I've listed a number of them in my testimony. It's important to understand, as the witnesses pointed out, OROSHA focuses 100% of its energy on safety issues. Every employer is mandated by state law now to have a safety committee that involves the employees of all the departments of the city. So fire districts would have a safety committee, each and every one of them. Cities might have a police department safety committee or a citywide safety committee or both. And those who serve on the safety committee have a charge. It's all recorded. OSHA inspects it. OSHA inspects for it. The workers' compensation rates, and I have included them in my materials, do not reflect that we have high injury, high death rates, or a disproportionate safety problem in either policing or in the fire service. The rates relative to numerous other occupations, relatively speaking, are quite low. If the union's bona fide concern here is truly firefighter safety, then it occurs to the fire chiefs in the fire service that this is sort of an ill-conceived solution, because two-thirds of the firefighters in Oregon are volunteers, and this solution doesn't impact or relate to them in any manner of speaking, because they're not represented. They don't bargain. We do discuss safety issues collaboratively, we do resolve them, and we do so regardless of whether there's a direct and substantial effect. The union's substitution of a potential impact test does open the door. Let me just give you some examples of bargaining proposals that I have dealt with within the last 60 to 90 days, one or two are a little bit older than that, that have been brought to the bargaining table under the guise of safety. The ability to wear stocking caps as a uniform item by a police officer. 24/7 chairs in the dispatch center. Interestingly enough, we already had 24/7 chairs that we paid $1,500 for. They wanted to bargain about it. We agreed that there was an impact. We talked about it, and there's a clear understanding. Trillium night sights on handguns, selection of weapons, should we have automatic rifles and shotguns visibly mounted in police cars, readily accessible to police officers? Issuance of brand new turnouts to probationary firefighters in contrast with serviceable but a little bit used, nonetheless properly fitting turnouts that they were dissatisfied with. The funding of a personal expense account for personal equipment like rescue knives. The number of firefighters on a fire engine and the like. Turning, if I may, to staffing. The Employment Relations Board has long recognized, as has the legislature, that staffing is a core management right. The proponents of the bill didn't speak to staffing particularly, but it seems to those on whose behalf I'm speaking that staffing and service priorities are central among the prerogatives of the of city councils, boards of county commissioners, and fire district boards of directors. And indeed, they're intensely budget-driven. In the case involving the city of Roseburg and the staffing issue, which was cast as a safety issue, what became very apparent was that staffing, at least in the fire service, is only a small piece of a very complex matrix, because in Roseburg the firefighters had demanded to bargain and objected to the reduction of minimum staffing to two firefighters on an engine. A decision that was made by the city and the city council, the city manager and the fire chief, in order to keep three fire stations open. There are now only two fire stations in Roseburg that are open, but that's a different story. In any event, Roseburg suffered through litigation over that point. I think with respect to staffing, beyond what Senator Prozanski I have in my written remarks, the point is that staffing is so central to the budget and so central to the service priority level that we should not be separately and additionally negotiating over layoffs and staffing decisions.
Thank you.
Lazenby. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Scott Lazenby, City Manager in Sandy. Just to add briefly, I've been involved in and responsible for preparing city budgets for the last 26 years, and I've seen pretty much everything in the public safety departments be proposed for budgetary approval on some basis of a safety implication. It's a broad topic that can cover the brand of radio we buy, the brand of tires we put on cars. It's anything that could potentially affect safety is pretty much a universal description of things. And so that alone is a concern, and as Aiken mentioned, that's just the half of it. The other is the whole open-ended area of staffing and workload levels. And if we've got to include that in collective bargaining that can go to arbitrary decisions through interest arbitration, then I would simply ask that you include an enormous appropriation in the state budget to bail us out for the costs that we would incur through this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Miles Ward, Assistant City Attorney with the City of Gresham. I'd like to briefly echo the comments made by Aiken Blitz. In my experience, officer safety and public safety are and always have been of paramount importance to public bodies. Management, though, has to make many choices and decisions when it comes to the number of employees it can afford to hire and what services that unit of government should provide. Every local government has a number of important services. They must be provided with efficiency and in accordance with the public body's duly adopted budget. Allowing an arbitrator to establish staffing levels and safety issues for public safety employees in an interest arbitration proceeding based on the vague standards in Senate Bill 321 of whether they might have a potential impact on either safety or on employee workloads is not a good decision. workloads? Do we really want arbitrators to be reviewing the workloads of public safety employees across the state and dictating to police and fire chiefs how many calls officers should answer in a given shift or in a given hour? A potential impact? Everything has a potential impact on everything else. This is the worst standard possible that could be elevated to law. And when you combine the proposed Senate Bill 319 that was discussed earlier, that would not allow an arbitrator to consider the cost of other services provided by a unit of government, with Senate Bill 321 that would allow an arbitrator to independently establish staffing levels, you put those two together, and this is a dramatic change from the old principle of when the money gives out, it's over. The current union contracts are all based on seniority, and when there's not enough money to pay all the employees, people do lose their jobs sometime, and jobs are protected on the basis of seniority. One of the direct impacts of Senate Bill 321 would be to give the arbitrator the position to determine how many employees should be hired and what they should be paid. And as Mr. Lazenby pointed out, unless somebody is going to put arbitrators in charge of property tax assessments and tax rates and everything else, this is a horrible solution in the guise of a public safety bill. That's all I have. Thank you.
Senator, do you have any questions?
Yes, I did. Just one, Chair Pesensky, for anyone there under all three of you, actually. Since Bill 750 passed in 1995, have arbitrations decisions generally favored labor, generally favored management, or have they been somewhat balanced?
Senator Pesensky, Senator Whitsitt, if I may, we keep track. We have a sheet that we add to with every new decision. They all go to the Employment Relations Board. We distribute it at a League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties seminar on healthcare just last week, a recap of every arbitration decision since Senate Bill 750. They are split 50-50 with a plus or minus one in terms of labor or management, in terms of the final offer that was accepted.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Gentlemen, again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I have here on the list, and we're here at 5 o'clock, I have one more bill that I'm going to take some testimony on, so I'm going to find out because I know Mr. Cock and Mr. Carter, y'all have been waiting patiently and wanted to give testimony on one of these three bills. If you still want to, please come forward. Mary Bodkin, I know that you wanted to be added to this. If you want to be here versus the other one, feel free to come forward. And I also have Mr. Schaefer, who I believe wanted to give testimony on 321. Walker, Porter, or did I miss Walker? And I apologize, I may have missed Mr. Walker as well. So. So I would say, why don't we start off with 3 and we'll do 3-3. Okay. Or 3-2.
Mostly we'd like to speak to 321.
Okay, that's what you're here. That's what we've got the record open for. Thank you very much for being here. And if I can get whoever's going to start off to identify themselves for the record, and please give us your testimony.
I'll start off first. My name is Joe Schaefer. I work for the Service Employees International Union, Local 503. And Senator Pesensky, or Chair Pesensky, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm currently in the role of a political organizer, but up until the beginning of January, I was an internal organizer and have bargained contracts for non-strikeable units. And I can speak firsthand to the frustration that the staff expressed towards not being able to talk about their safety concerns at the bargaining table. We were told well in advance of negotiating the contract that staffing wouldn't be an issue that was talked about. And so for these folks, primarily in a juvenile detention center who sees their role as providing safety to the public, not to be able to talk about safety at the bargaining table is really frustrating. And to be barred by law is really just unacceptable to us. I think that we owe it more to our public safety workers that if they're going to protect us, that we should at least allow them to bargain over the safety issues that they have at the table. And to say that this is going to somehow like supersede management's rights is just somewhat laughable. We're not talking about brands of radios. We're talking about the ratio of detention workers to detainees. Those are the things that we want to talk about. And that's the kind of stuff that our members have been extremely concerned about and called OSHA and really found no recourse there. OSHA doesn't really do anything about the ratios that they have in detention centers. And so to be barred by law to talk about their safety is just something that we think is really inexcusable.
Thank you.
Yes, my name is John Cox, Senator Kazansky, thank you. I've been with Oregon Youth Authority and Juvenile Corrections for 41 years. During this time, I've seen a lot of changes, and we're going through a change period right at this present time. From a social welfare kind of a situation, trying to get over to a corrections model. Our population has changed. We are serving about 70% Department of Corrections young men. The offenses due to our downsizing have been compressed into the most serious of offenses in the state. Our age has gone from 14 years age to almost 20 years of age now. And we're going to go through another round of compression due to budget issues. We're losing more bed space. What this has resulted in, basically, is our assault level is up. Assaults against other clientele, against staff members are up. We have lost four staff permanently over the last 2 years that cannot come back and work anymore. Over 10% of our staff is permanent part-time people who have been there for a short time. We feel that this bill would give us an opportunity to sit down with management, to share our concerns, and it isn't just a question of necessarily fairness, but it's also the idea that we can, together work out issues as far as training is concerned, about staffing patterns is concerned, and about dealing with the new clientele that we do have. This is about the safety of our community, and it's also about the safety of the people that work with me at McLaren, is where I work at this time. So I urge that you consider this bill and pass this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
I'm Roy Carter. I work at OYA. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and honored members of your committee here for hearing me out. Basically, I deal with OYA is not just a McLaren issue. We have something like 9 facilities throughout the state. Our ratio of DOC, which is Department of Correction Youth, our clients are increasing. When we want to sit down and talk about staffing patterns, staffing that we need, we can tell you some nightmares about what goes on down at Hillcrest. I can tell you nightmares about other places on the staffing. And I apologize that I wasn't better prepared for this.
Doing great.
But dealing as former vice president of Local 415, which is OYA, talking to staff throughout the state, visiting the facilities throughout the state, and hearing their stories that we're told about safety issues, staffing issues, and other issues that have come up, this not only affects the police and the firefighters. It also affects your people who keep your juveniles detained. It also deals with folks who work down at the state hospital who have to work with some of the more violent offenders because they're too violent for DOC or whatever. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. Any questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. I believe we still have Mr. Walker and Mary. Were you going to come up too? Okay. Is there anyone else in the room that wanted to give testimony on 321? All right. Mr. Walker, please go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Senator Brzezinski and committee. I work at the oil.
I need you to please identify yourself for the record.
Okay. Jim Walker. I work at Oregon State Hospital. I am a mental health therapist, therapy coordinator there, which is to say that I'm a lead worker. I make things happen there. I'm the straw boss. I believe that you all received this information that's in front of you. Mandatory overtimes, and I'm going to kind of speak towards that. Every day, the hospital is mandating people because of the short staffing issues there. The workers that work there are part of the non-strikeable. It's not just police firemen. We also are non-strikeable. The officers drop off these people at our doorstep, and we take them. And so whatever the issues are when they get to the hospital, they continue if they're aggressive and assaultive, that we have to provide staffing ratios for that. I worked 48B, which is maximum security, for a year and a half. If you look at the numbers, there's 208 Band-Aids that we received working there because we're short-staffed. Myself, personally, I worked 29 mandates where I was required to stay there. We don't have choice. We're required by management to stay there because that's the way it is. That's the policy. They dictate what our staffing levels are, and we have to abide by that. So for me to stay 29 times a year, that's a lot. And that's not counting. These numbers here are not counting how many overtimes are worked. This is the ones that are just, you have to stay, and that's the way it is. So your life is put on hold. It'd be like, I've noticed the committee members getting up and getting down, and you're down to three now. That happens a lot at the hospital, too. So, for instance, this room has maybe 40 people, and suddenly you have three people in here to watch them. Well, two of you are going to be in the kitchen, or one of you is going to be in the hallway. And you got someone that's aggressive, and you're by yourself. This happens all the time. It's really not safe. The staffing levels are low, and these numbers will support that. These numbers probably reflect only one-fourth of how many overtimes are being worked there because of low staffing numbers. When you're required to work, you stay there 8 hours and you go home. It's 11:30 at night, and you have to be there in the morning again at 6:30 doing it all over. Sometimes I've been mandated 3 days in a row, and it's all because we have a lack of staffing. You work with assaultive people. It's a highly abrasive situation. The patients there are mandated by court to be there, so they don't really want to be there, and we control the keys. We're therapists, and we do the best we can, but at some point, it becomes us against them kind of mentality. So, how do I sum this up? It's just so abrasive that if you're required to work with someone that is threatening to kill you 3 hours ago, and I say, Senator Braun, you have to stay an extra shift because this guy is aggressive and he hates you. That's the way it is. So you're his target and you're going to be there another 8 hours. We need more staff. What we need really is a voice to say, okay, here's our numbers and we would like to have more staff. But right now, under the present situation, that we're not given a voice to do this. If you have any questions, please.
Any questions? Thank you, sir. Yeah. Mary.
I will be very brief, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here tonight representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Senator Whitsitt, you were not in the building during these years, but Senator Brzezinski was. He was in the other chamber. Because we were not, as a union, allowed to discuss safety issues at the table, we have been forced three times to come to this body and pass laws to get safety equipment for our officers in the state penitentiaries around Oregon. The first time it was to get rid of free weights and weight bars in the exercise yards of the institutions. This occurred after two of our officers were almost killed by an inmate by beating them to the ground with weight bars. The next time was for safety vests, for stab-proof vests, after three of our officers were stabbed by inmates. It doesn't make sense to me to have to come to this building and pass laws to do things that make sense to do at the bargaining table. We have safety officers in prisons who have never been in the yard when there are inmates in the yard. They're in the management services. This makes no sense to me. And this bill doesn't do anything except say you got to talk about it. And to send us to the legislature to pass laws for things we could settle at the bargaining table just simply doesn't make any sense to me. So we urge you to pass this bill. And I'll come talk to you individually on it. I don't want to take any more time.
All right.
Unless you just have questions.
Senator, just one quick question. How would you define safety measures? You know, I mean, we've heard both sides of the story here. Certainly, someone coming after you with a barbell or a knife is a safety item. Whether you have a new gun or an old gun or a stocking cap is not. So it seems to me that there seems to be some middle ground there, and perhaps.
And I think we ought to try and find the middle ground. I mean, all I can tell you is. I had one officer who had 6 months on the job beaten to the ground three times by an inmate who took her radio and beat her in the face, and she still managed to climb up and subdue the inmate who was beating her. The officer who was in the tower had a weapon that was fairly new, but it had outdated ammunition, so her weapon jammed. So she couldn't even fire a warning shot. I mean, this is crazy stuff, and we're getting beyond it, but it's just through sheer will and determination, not because, and probably because Max Williams is there now. I mean, to be really honest, but these are very serious issues, and we have to be able to at least talk about it. And it only takes one word from management to stop the discussion. The word is no. Now, if management doesn't have the courage to say no at the bargaining table, then they need to get new bargainers. It seems simple to me.
You're not really addressing my question.
I'm sorry.
How do we define what is?
I'm not sure, but I'm willing to work with you on it.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I thought I did say that.
All right. That's fine. Any other questions? All right, both of you, thank you very much. Unless there's someone else here who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 321, I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 321. And it's the intent of the chair to have a work group working these three bills, as I mentioned at the very beginning. I will work through my administrator, Ms. Braun, as to trying to get something set up. I'm not sure it's the time frame, except I can tell you're going to be moving very quickly. Based on the complexity of what I see in these three bills and seeing if we can get something established. If those who are here or those who may have left that we have contact with are interested, I would ask you to submit names to Ms. Braun. And what we're going to do is we will try to make certain that we have a cross-section of individuals from the different perspectives part of that work group. But at the same time, I also realize that we cannot have 20 or 30 people in the room or we're not going to be able to get anything done. So that will be submitted to me, and we'll try to work through it and see if we can get sure that we have representation across the board, and we'll have individuals that can work as subsets or leads for those other people. Thank you very much for those who came for those three bills. I do have one other bill that's scheduled to be heard today. We are after time, but I am willing to stay myself
As you can see, I had commitments from other senators that had to leave. I'm not sure Senator Wissett is going to be able to stay. I've told him he can leave if he needs to. And so I'm more than willing to take testimony. We will not be able to move this bill, not only because I don't have the senators, but also, probably more importantly, we have not received at this point a financial impact statement. And based on the SNS that we have right now, it says one that's not issued. And so we need to have that before we can move forward on that. So that's the reason we're not going to be able to move it, besides not having the people today. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give the parties. I looked here at the list for 426. Everyone that has signed up is less than 100 miles, but I would expect that there are some people. I know that the Representative Rosenbaum would like to probably give testimony today. I'm more than willing to open up that and take some of it. We may, if we don't accommodate everyone, just carry this over. Today is Thursday, so I'm not sure what our Tuesday looks like.
We can carry it on the
what we'll do is we'll post it and have it ready for Tuesday, and so we will do that. But I am willing to stay here to take some testimony now for those who find it more convenient to do it today. If not, I'd ask if you could come back on Tuesday of next week. We will take the rest of the testimony on Senate Bill 426. Yeah. Okay. So at this point, I'm going to go ahead and open this hearing on Senate Bill 426, just for informational purposes, since my ranks are down, but I will be taking public testimony at this time. So what I'm going to do, the parties that are, everyone knows who signed up, Diane, I assume you want to give testimony, please come on up. And
thank you. Mr. Chair, can Tim Nesbitt come up with
me? Yeah, I was going to say, if you have anyone that wanted to join you, Tim, you're more than welcome. And anyone else? Well, I guess I'm going to ask just so I can kind of get a clarity of who wants to testify today. Those who want to testify today, if you raise your hand so I just know. Tom, I know you're here. I don't know if you want to come back on Tuesday, if you want to do anything today. So at this point, just so I make sure I know what I've got on my sheet, is who wants to give testimony today. Representative Rosenbaum, Tim Nesbitt, and is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today? Okay, with that, what we will do, we will post it. It will be back up on Tuesday of this next week. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing Senate Bill 426. I am Diane Rosenbaum, and I am the State Representative for House District 42 in Southeast and Northeast Portland. I'm also appearing today in my capacity as President of the National Labor Caucus of State Legislators, which is a national organization of over 500 elected officials from around the country, from virtually every state in the union. I am here in support of Senate Bill 426, and I think it's an extremely important bill that really is a matter of basic fairness for the workers of Oregon. When employees sign up to become members of a union, their intent is clear. Senate Bill 426 simply requires that the Oregon Employment Relations Board recognize a union when a verified majority of eligible workers have signed authorization cards. Under current law, workers are essentially forced into two votes on whether or not they want to form a union. Workers must first sign union authorization cards stating that they want a union, and then even though they've already stated their intentions, they must file for an election with the Employment Relations Board to once again declare their support for a union. For many employers, the process of an election is just a chance to interfere in the free choice of workers to form a union. Employers exercise a large amount of control over an employee's day-to-day activities, shift scheduling, and pay. Even when employers cross the line and break the law, the remedies are often so weak that they have no real effect. And I really want to stress this point, because I can, and I'm sure that others can also, tell you of stories of workers who have been in one-on-one situations with supervisory employees, riding around with them in their trucks all day, where they're basically a captive audience. And it's extremely intimidating in those situations for people to have to withstand that kind of pressure. So the bill presents the solution to this problem, which is to allow workers, public employees who are covered under the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, to form a union through a process that is commonly known as card check, or it's now more frequently being called majority verification. Card check means that the workers may have their union recognized if a majority sign up to be represented. Through a signature process, workers who want to form a union sign union authorization cards, then give the cards to the Employment Relations Board for verification. Current law forces workers to go through a difficult process to exercise their freedom to form a union. Since the process is built around determining a majority, we should respect the will of a majority of workers who sign cards. By passing Senate Bill 426, we can establish a fair process that protects a worker's freedom to form a union. I did want to make mention of one potential problem in the language in this bill, and that is that the bill currently calls for the cards that have been signed to be presented to the employer as a evidence that
I
the workers...
Do you have references to just the, where we know...
You know, I don't have the bill in front of me. I'm sorry. Perhaps Mr. Nesbitt can find it. It is in line 28 of the first page of the bill. That word could be problematic because what it seems to call for is for the names of the people who have signed these cards to be given to the employer, which could just be a license to even further pressure to be put on those. And we would prefer to see that change to something like a word like demonstrate. Perhaps the Employment Relations Board could be the repository for those cards so that there could be sort of a firewall between the employer and these unprotected employees.
Okay. Well, what we can do, this appears to be a bill that was introduced to the Rules Committee. What I will do is we'll take the testimony, but we'll also... I'll have Ms. Braun taking notes, so if it looks like we need to do some type of amendments, that we can go ahead and get those taken care of. All right. Thank you, Diane, for being here. And I have no questions for you. And because of that, Tim?
Chair Pruszynski, thank you. I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the AFL-CIO in Oregon. Behind me is Matt Swanson, who will be back on Tuesday with at least written testimony to turn in as well.
Okay.
And thank you for taking me today, because I wouldn't be able to be back Tuesday afternoon in front of your committee. Very briefly, if there's a principle underlying this bill, it's that when it comes to forming a union, a demonstrated verified majority of workers in an appropriate bargaining unit should always be sufficient. This principle is not only consistent with the internationally recognized right of workers to form unions, but also the policy of the state of Oregon as expressed in ORS 243.656. And it actually promotes and protects that right as well. So what this bill says is that once you have the explicit written expression of intent from a majority of employees in an appropriate unit or grouping of jobs, that majority, once verified by a third party, which is the clarification that Representative Rosenbaum seeks here, should then mean that we move forward to recognition and bargaining, because doing so will actually be more cost-effective for public employers and taxpayers, more timely and less wasteful of public resources, and finally more conducive to the exercise of the right of workers to form a union and bargain. You might take into account also that when we're talking about a threshold which is a majority of all affected workers, that's actually a higher threshold than a majority vote in an election where the turnout might be less than 100%. So you will probably hear also about potential problems. That's why we have an Employment Relations Board. That's why we have a dispute resolution procedure. If anybody alleged that workers were coerced, that would be illegal. That would be an unfair labor practice. That's something that ERB would handle. And again, just I think two clarifications will be needed as you consider an amendment. One is, again, that the authorizations would not be presented to directly to the employer, but to a third party, and the demonstration of a majority then would be presented to the employer. I think it probably would be helpful also to clarify what we've all been speaking to so far, and that we're talking about an appropriate bargaining unit. It's not just a random grouping of workers, but all those who would, by ERB precedent, qualify as an appropriate bargaining unit, because that then sets the denominator of that fraction you have to look at, those who sign versus those who potentially could have signed. So I think those two clarifications would tighten this up a lot, and hopefully that could be accomplished in a single amendment.
Thank you very much. And
thank you.
I have no questions. Thank you.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony at this point? All right, what we're going to do on 426, I want to apologize for everyone that's here. Of course, as you sat through today's, we had a lot of other, let's say, discussions and hearing testimony that came in more than I thought we were going to have. What we'll do, we'll make SB 426 a priority for Tuesday. So what we'll do is we'll start off with it, and then we'll continue with the rest of our Tuesday docket. So thank you again very much, and for those who will see you on Tuesday, see you then. If not, we'll see you whenever. We'll be closing Senate Commerce Committee.